welcome to Tuned to Yesterday, broadcasting shows from radio's golden era. I'm your host, Mark Levanier, and in this hour, True History, we'll hear the Army Air Force show Eyes Aloft coming up later in the hour, but now the story of Mary Putnam Jacoby, known as a social reformer and one of the first female doctors to push the rights of women in professions. Her story, dramatized next from June 14, 1943 on NBC, with Madeline Carroll as star.
The Cavalcade of America, sponsored by DuPont, maker of better things for better living through chemistry, presents Madeline Carroll in Make Way for the Lady. We are at the turn of the century. In a brownstone house in Midtown, New York, an old woman is seated in her wheelchair by the window.
These human ailments, Doctor, why do they come when one is just beginning to learn how to live with one's fellow men? I have become so aware of time. There is so little of it left for me. Yes, I know the truth now. I have diagnosed my symptoms. I know the inevitable. I listen to the clock, and it seems that all my life I have raced ahead of time. But now time races ahead of me. Do you remember Godey's Lady's book, Doctor? That mid-Victorian world into which I was born? That world of puffed sleeves and lace and stuffed owls and stuffed minds. Oh, I fluttered the dove coat in my day. I caused some eyebrows to be raised. Eyebrows and voices.
But you can't do it, lady.
A woman, Doctor? Don't make me laugh.
Why doesn't she just stay home and have children? Votes for women, huh? Next thing you know, they'll be wanting to wear pants.
Gallivanting over half the world, just like a man. Who does she think she is? Queen Victoria?
Woman's place is in the home, if she's normal. Votes for women? Why, I don't want to vote. I love my husband.
There must be something funny in a woman to make her do a thing like that. Well, I wouldn't be surprised.
Yes, that's the way it was. Always being stared at, as if I were a creature from another planet. I suppose I was, in a way. To live ahead of one's time is to live in another world. Another world. And so I got used to being looked at as somewhat odd. I remember the first time it happened, when that sentry greeted me as I came into the camp.
Hey, miss. What are you doing here?
I wish to see my brother, Sergeant Haven Putnam.
There's no place for a lady. Don't you know the Confederate Army is just beyond that ridge? How'd you get here, anyway?
I got a pass from Colonel Holabird in New Orleans. Here, look.
Hmm?
My brother's ill with malaria. I've come to nurse him. Where is he?
Well, I'll be dogged. You sure got your nerve.
Will you please take me to my brother, or do I have to ask...
Ah, don't get excited, miss. Follow me. In this tent. There he is, see? Oh, Sergeant Putnam. A lady to see you.
Minnie... What are you doing here?
We got your letter, Haven. I've come to nurse you.
But how'd you get here all the way from New York?
Oh, Father arranged it.
You came alone?
Of course I came alone.
Oh, good heavens. How did Father permit such a thing? Well, you might have been...
Oh, lie still. And I wouldn't have been anything. I can take care of myself.
Sure can, Sergeant. Never seen anything like it. Walked right into camp here as calm as if she was in her own parlor.
Never mind that. Go tell the doctor I'm at his disposal and get me some cold compresses. Hurry. My brother recovered, and in a little while was his same old self again. But not me. I had changed. What I saw in that hospital, the suffering and pain and death, changed me. I wanted to help. And I could do so little. If only I knew more. But women didn't know much in those days. It wasn't fashionable. And when you did know something, you tried to hide it. That was genteel. That was womanly. During my journey home, I made up my mind. You know the way you do it sometimes. You ask yourself questions, and then you try to give the answers. And suddenly you realize how silly it is, because your mind is made up. Only one thing did I insist on. I would do what I wanted, be what I wanted, and be a woman, too.
Now, Minnie, don't put words in my mouth. I didn't say that.
What did you say, Father?
I simply suggested you postpone it for a while. You know what this war has done to the publishing business.
Besides, Minnie, you've already secured your degree in pharmacy. There isn't another young lady in the country who has done that. Should imagine your pride would rest content for a while.
Pride? What's pride got to do with it? I want to help Mother.
Can't you help by being a pharmacist?
I want to be a doctor.
Why a doctor? Minnie, even a literary career would be less indelicate. Perhaps with my publishing connections...
Father, I want to be a doctor.
A female doctor. Good heavens. Why, it's a contradiction in terms. It's like a square circle.
Are the Blackwell sisters square circles? Would you call their work at the New York Infirmary useless, indelicate?
I don't know what you'd call them. They most certainly are not ladies.
I don't want to be a lady either.
What have I done now?
Hand me the smelling salts. Now, there, Mother. There. Sniff this. That's better, my dear.
Minnie, what a thing to say.
I'm sorry, Mother. Let's put it this way. I want to be a doctor and a lady. But I simply refuse to spend my life as so many women do, clinging like a vine to some man. I want to help people, Father. Help, not hinder. I will not be useless. Poor dear Father. He was an enlightened man for his day, but a female doctor, that was almost more than he could bear. When I came home with my degree from the Women's Medical College that spring of 1864, he still had forebodings.
Well, now, Minnie, here it is, a shining copper plate for the front door.
I hope the neighbors aren't scandalized.
Oh, let's put it up now.
Very well, though I doubt it'll do more than amuse the peddlers.
Mary Putnam, M.D.,
Mary Putnam, M.D. Well.
I wonder if she examines you with your clothes on or...
It's indecent, that's what it is. And her father, a Putnam.
I wouldn't go to her with a sore toe. Sooner go to the barber. At least he's a man.
Yes, at least he's a man. That's it. That's what they said. But I expected it. I had hope that maybe... But I expected it. And that shining copper shingle of mine gathered the wind and the rain, but no patience. Once in a long while, the doorbell would jangle. Yes?
I'd like to see the doctor, please.
I'm the doctor.
I beg your pardon, miss. I said I'd like to see the doctor, please.
I heard you. I'm the doctor. Now, what's the trouble?
You? Oh... I guess it ain't nothing, miss. Excuse me.
And then one day it happened. I stood it as long as I could, but the prejudice was more than I could endure. So one day I decided it was time for action. I took the hammer and went out on the porch.
Mother, Mother!
What is it?
Minnie's gone crazy or something.
What do you mean? What's she doing?
Well, she's ripping her doctor sign off the door. Look!
Minnie, child, what are you doing?
I refuse to be a practitioner without a practice. Yes, that was a bitter summer. And suddenly I knew I had to get away. Far away. As far away as I could go.
Paris.
What next?
The most famous professors of medicine in the world are in Paris.
Mary, you're a good girl. And for a female, you're not unintelligent.
Thank you, Father.
But it's about time you understood one thing. It's not your lack of medical knowledge that's driving patients away. It's your lack of pants.
Sure.
I beg your pardon, Mother. Indeed, I do. I beg your pardon.
To tell you the truth, I'm not much of a doctor, Father. Not much more than a nurse, really. After all, how much training have I had? 2 years of chemistry, a year at medical school. But with a degree from the École de Médecine,
Ah, then you'd have a real doctor in the family.
But I don't want a real doctor in the family. And above all, I don't want a female one.
How would you live in Paris? You know your father's finances have touched bottom.
I have some savings. I could live on them. And I could tutor and write occasional pieces for the American papers, just as I wrote those articles down in New Orleans. Father could arrange that.
Oh, yes, indeed. Father can arrange anything.
I knew you would agree. Here, look. Oh, so that's where my yellow jar disappeared. I've been wondering.
What's that?
Here, hold out your hand. See, I have already changed my savings into gold Napoleons.
Mary Putnam, you have the will of a... Yes, you may go to Paris, but heaven help the French.
Two months after my arrival, I had already gained permission to enter the Lariboisière, a general hospital, and the Salpêtrière for nervous diseases and the insane. But as for the great iron gateway of the École de Médecine...
No, mademoiselle, it is impossible.
Why impossible?
Why simply because it is impossible.
We Americans do not recognize that word.
But then you Americans are a strange people, mademoiselle. You tell me you are already a doctor in your country. Perhaps so, but here...
Here, I suppose you consider it indelicate for a woman to be a doctor.
Oh, no, mademoiselle, an Englishman might perhaps say that. We Frenchmen consider that it is dangerous.
Dangerous? Monsieur, do I look dangerous?
In a class of young men, let us say an anatomy class. Yes, very dangerous.
There it was again. No females wanted. I stood outside the École, knocking, knocking, knocking. But prejudice and tradition kept me out. Then one day I had to see the secretary of the faculty for a card to attend the École Pratique. I stood before him in his office.
Oh, but yes, I have viewed mademoiselle in many of the clinics, I believe.
Gracious, it sounds as if I were being inspected.
It is possible.
But, monsieur, last year I applied for permission merely to attend the lectures and I was refused.
I know, I was the one who refused.
But then...
Since then I have learned that the Minister of Public Instruction is much interested in the question of women doctors. And since we must always look for an opportunity to please the minister...
But the secretary reckoned without the faculty, and the faculty said no. My moods ran gray and gloomy as the river. One day at the dinner table, my landlady said to me,
"Why, mademoiselle, you have scarcely touched the food. What is the trouble? Do you not like my pot-au-feu?"
"Oh, it's delicious, but I'm afraid I'm not hungry."
"No? Then you are in love, perhaps."
I don't think so.
You can think you are not in love. Perhaps it is because you have been refused admission to the medical school.
Madame Artum, you are a shrewd woman.
Oh, but why be depressed, Sherry? There are ways, you know.
Ways?
You tell me you are acquainted with Madame Garnier. Well, Madame Garnier is acquainted with the minister. What could be simpler? You will excuse me, mademoiselle, but you are a woman, n'est-ce pas?
Yes. Yes, I begin to see what you mean.
There he is, Mary. Now remember, it is the woman who will get the doctor into the école. Ah, Monsieur Le Ministre.
Madame Garnier.
I would like you to meet the young friend of whom I spoke, Mademoiselle Putnam from America.
Mademoiselle, I am enchanted.
Thank you, Monsieur Le Ministre.
Ah, what a sparkle here tonight. Oh, it is as if... Ah, there's René. I must speak with him. Excuse me?
Certainly. Madame Garnier tells me you are a physician. It does not seem possible.
Shall I show you my diploma?
It would be useless, mademoiselle. But why are you so interested in getting into our École de Médecine?
I have a degree and just enough science to know that I know nothing. That is why I came to your country. There are no greater medical schools in the world than here in France.
Men and women in the same class, Isn't that something like touching flame to gunpowder?
Oh, monsieur, my sole interest is science.
And with such a gracious figure. What a pity. Oh, well, mademoiselle, perhaps something can be done. Do not lose heart. Shall we dance?
You are listening to Madeline Carroll in Make Way for the Lady on the Cavalcade of America, sponsored by the DuPont Company. Our play is about Mary Putnam Jacoby, one of America's first woman doctors. As it continues, Mary Putnam is about to realize her ambition to be admitted to the famous École de Médecine in Paris, where no woman has ever been admitted before.
I tell you, she will make a splendid physician. She has ability and she is not unattractive, huh?
It will not help. Mark my words. The uproar of the students will be frightful.
We shall see.
I'm glad it's not my class, mon vieux. Ah, look, the professor takes his place. The class comes to attention.
She seems calm enough.
Just wait.
Monsieur, madame.
What? No riots? No insults?
That's all a bit disappointing.
It is history. Place aux dames. Make way for the ladies. The first woman enters l'école de médecine.
My first examination. I was nervous, worried. When the ordeal was over, I retired to the coat room to wait for the usher who would bring in the decision. When I got there...
Mary!
Jacques, what are you doing here?
Be calm now. Don't get excited. Here, sit down. Drink this water. I remember how nervous I was when I was...
Well, for heaven's sake, Jacques, you're more excited than I.
Just be calm, Mary. Oh, here comes the usher.
Oh.
No, it is the professors themselves.
Ah, mademoiselle, would you like me to tell you the grade you have received?
If you would be so kind.
We have decided on très satisfait. Very satisfactory. It is the highest mark.
So the years went by, and the time came for me to go home. I was sick as usual during that homeward voyage. But my heart was bright as the spray that sparkled in our wake. I was a doctor. I was only 29 when I opened my office in the basement of our family home. And the following autumn, I began to teach at the Woman's Medical College. And then that great day came when the Medical Society of the County of New York admitted me to membership. I can still hear Dr. Abraham Jacoby, the newly elected president, as he made his inaugural address.
Paris has turned out a woman doctor who will, I hope, prove to be an ornament of this society, the profession of this city, and our common country. Let it not be forgotten in the history of this society that we have now opened our doors to worthy members of the medical profession, male or female, white or colored, and thus granted reality to the gospel of American citizenship.
Dr. Jacoby, I don't think you've met the young lady you were just talking about.
No, I have not had the pleasure.
Then allow me. Dr. Putnam, may I present Dr. Abraham Jacoby? Don't let him frighten you. He's really quite human.
He was human, all right. I married Dr. Jacoby shortly after, and we were very happy. But as I looked around at the America of that day, lifting its people to higher and higher standards, freeing its slaves of color and its slaves of labor, yet I saw the millions of my own sex still unredeemed. And finally, at the New York State Constitutional Convention of 1890...
Gentlemen, convention will please come to order.
Dr. Mary Jacoby.
Gentlemen, it is with a deep sense of the momentous importance of our errand that we present ourselves before you this
day. Women belong in the home, not in public life.
Women are adequately represented by the male vote.
What about the family?
Gentlemen, please.
We've heard enough of these absurd demands. Go back to your laboratory, Doctor.
Laboratory? Send her back to her kitchen.
You must and you will listen. Gentlemen, the moment has at last arrived when women may, with equal justice and decorum, come forward to claim a place among the other powers of the earth.
This is no time to press such a demand. Other issues are too critical.
Are you claiming that political rights may be demanded only when political life shall have ceased to exist? No, gentlemen. The time to press the demand
women
is when someone...
Women's suffrage has no place in democracy.
Then you are saying that after 100 years of trial, democracy has proved such a failure that its principles must now be repudiated. How can democracy prove other than a failure when the citizens of a free state cease to believe in it? How can political affairs move among large issues if the only ideas which are abroad, which are respected, are fatally small? No, gentlemen, I refuse to believe that. For good or for ill, the question of the rights of women has been raised and will not down.
Now, be quiet, children. Don't you see your grandmother sleeping?
Who's been sleeping? I've been writing a long letter.
Why, Mother, you wrote only a few lines. There, look, the paper's fallen to the floor.
I must have dozed off. What time is it?
I don't know. The clock seems to have stopped.
Oh.
Grandma, Grandma, tell us a story.
A story, my dears? My story has been told.
Thank you, Madeline Carroll. Next week, the Cavalcade of America will dramatize the story of a gallant ship. Wounded in battle, her rudder shot away, yet valiantly making her way 10,000 miles through sub-infested waters to her home port. The new glory won by this grand old ship has earned for her the title the Unsinkable Marblehead. Next week, with Dean Jagger as our star, DuPont will tell this exciting story in an original play by Charles K. Freeman. Be with us next week when DuPont presents Dean Jagger as its star in The Unsinkable Marblehead, an epic story of naval heroism on the Cavalcade of America. The orchestra and musical score tonight were under the direction of Donald Voorhees. This is Clayton Collier sending best wishes from Cavalcade sponsor, the DuPont Company of Wilmington, Delaware.
The Cavalcade of America, on Tuned to Yesterday from June 14, 1943, on the NBC Red Network, the story of Mary Putnam Jacoby. She was the first woman to become a member of the Academy of Medicine in 1872. It's an hour of true history on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm your host, Mark LeVanier. And now a wartime broadcast of Eyes Aloft, their third program produced by the Army Air Force's 4th Fighter Command and West Coast radio stations, and an interesting look at the Aircraft Warning Service, volunteers who would watch the skies at night during the Second World War for enemy planes. A great illustration of their work and volunteerism in this next half hour, hosted by Gayne Whitman and announcer Ken Carpenter from August 31st, 1942 on NBC.
Eyes Aloft!
Army flash. One, multi-motor, high, seen, Angelus 51, overhead, southeast.
Eyes aloft, watching the sky, watching the sky.
ship a plane, flying the lanes up above. Eyes aloft.
Eyes aloft. The 4th Fighter Command of the United States Army Air Forces, in cooperation with West Coast radio stations, presents this new series of Monday evening programs honoring the 150,000 volunteer observers and filter center workers whose round-the-clock vigilance keeps watchful guard of the Pacific Coast against attack by enemy planes.
Rise the Lord, night and day, we'll help protect the USA.
Ken Carpenter speaking. Tonight, the third edition of Eyes Aloft. You'll hear the weekly presentation of the handsome Eyes Aloft Gold Trophy Award to some outstanding observation post or filter center. Dramatized true stories. The Gordon Jenkins Orchestra and Sportsman Quartet give musical salute to another branch of national defense, the United States Coast Guard. And you'll hear in person from the last man to fly out of Bataan, Major Henry Thorne. Here now, your Eyes Aloft narrator, the popular radio motion picture and newsreel commentator, Gayne Whitman.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Few have ever heard the story of Fagan's Tower. San Mateo County, California, the peninsula, Hillsboro. Last January 6th, three men stopped their car on the crest of Black Mountain and got out. The day was gray and dismal. No sun. A mile away, an ominous winter fog bank hung as a shroud about the shoulders of the rolling seacoast hills to the west. The three men crawled through a barbed wire fence. Silently, they climbed the slope of the small knoll. At the top, they stopped to survey the view.
Well, this is the spot I recommend.
Yeah, the view is good.
There's always wind.
There's usually fog.
And you get permission to set up an observation post shack on this knoll?
I think so.
You're 1,000 feet off the road. In rainy, muddy weather, you can't expect women to climb up here.
We can put a gate in the fence and cars can drive right up.
Of course, it'll cost a little something to run electricity and telephone lines in here.
How do you hope to finance this construction, Mr. Hoffman?
Well, I don't know, Captain.
Well, you boys better start figuring before you get too far into it. Come on, boys. It's cold. That fog's coming in. Back to our car.
Those three men were Captain Underwood, Ground Observation Officer of the Northern California region, San Mateo County Director Lloyd Heckman, and Ed Hoffman, prominent San Mateo attorney and chief observer. The object was to relocate and build a more advantageous Hillsboro post. The proposition of finance was a devastating obstacle until 1 week later, a well-known Hillsboro resident talked with the county director. The gentleman was Mr. Paul Fagan.
Well, Mr. Hickman, I've heard about this ground observer thing some of you people are doing for the Army. You want to put up a new post?
We have to, Mr. Fagan. Our community is going to do a good job of reporting planes.
You want to build back up there on Black Mountain, I understand.
Yes, we've arranged with the Spring Valley Company for the free use of the location.
Now, look here. I want to help out with our community war effort problems.
We need help.
How much does it cost to build an observation post?
Well, I don't know exactly. It depends. We haven't gone into the complete costs yet.
Well, here. I made out a check. It's signed. Here.
Well, an opening contribution like this will help, Mr. Fagan. Wait a minute. What's this?
It's my check.
Yes, but it's for $2,500, man.
Well, this ground observer thing must be pretty good, or the Army wouldn't be asking people to help. I'm all for it. I want to help out the only way I can right now.
Good Lord, Mr. Fagan. $2,500.
Less than 30 days later, February, the new post was ready for operation. It was a magnificent 20-foot-high tower. The room was glass-enclosed, and there was a catwalk around the outside. There were electric heaters, a grill, bottled spring water, even rubber boots and slickers. 1,000 feet of gravel road had been built into the location. Lloyd Heckman and Ed Hoffman called at Paul Fagan's home the night before the post was to officially open.
Well, Mr. Fagan, the post is built. We have everything.
Well, I'm glad we've got a good one.
We've named the post after you. It's officially named the Fagan Tower.
Well, that wasn't in the least necessary.
Well, everybody appreciates your generosity.
Say, what do you boys want tonight?
Mr. Fagan, you gave us a check a month ago for $2,500.
Well?
Tonight, we want to give you a check.
You want to give me a check? How come? We have receipts for every expenditure.
Yeah, Mr. Fagan, the check we have for you. And thanks for everything.
What is this?
$869.
Yeah, we only spent $1,631 of what you gave us.
Well, how do you like that? I get money back. This is the first time in my whole life that I haven't been taken over the cold.
Well, this is for national defense. This is for the Army, Mr. Fagan.
Well, this is America. One observation post costs $1,631 to build, and that's all right. But hundreds upon hundreds of other posts have never cost anything. Like Topsy, they've just grown. Anyway, on February 7th, Hillsborough Post went into operation without fanfare, without dedication or ceremony. Two observers were just coming on watch that first evening. Fog was creeping in, shifting. The wind was unusually strong and pounded the hill. There was a man waiting at the foot of the steps as the observers approached.
Hey, Joe, look, someone's waiting for us.
Well, who is it?
Can't see.
How'd he get here? No car waiting down at the bottom of the hill.
Come on. Gosh, it's windy.
Hope our tower doesn't get blown over the first night it's in operation.
Come on, Joe.
Yeah, I'm coming. This is the slipperiest stuff I ever walked. Speed, too.
Hi, boys.
Who is it?
I heard you'd be up here about this time. I've been waiting to see you.
Well, what's the matter? Oh, it's Mr. Darcy.
Yeah, glad you got here. Something for both of you.
Oh?
I got to get back over to the road. My people are driving back to pick me up in a few minutes now. Here you are, boys. One for you.
What is this?
And one for you. The keys to the observation post door. Compliments of Darcy's sports shop.
Hey, that's fine, Mr. Darcy.
Had over 200 of them made up. I thought they'd be practical now and a souvenir after the war's over.
Say, that's fine. Thanks a lot. You want to climb up and take a look around?
Oh, thanks. I have to hurry along. I just wanted to personally present the first two keys myself. Terrible windy tonight, isn't it?
It's really a bad one.
Oh, good night, Mr. Darcy. Thanks again for the keys.
I'll see you boys later.
All right.
Night. Well, we better climb up the tower, Joe, and get started.
Say, you don't suppose this thing could be blown over?
Well, it might, but I hope not.
Well, I hope not either. You know, this ground here is shale, and it's awful hard to work. I don't think the boys put these main pillars in any too deep.
Well, I'd hate to be in the top of this tower if it ever decided to go rattling down the hill. We'd better get upstairs.
Okay.
Hey, what's that?
I don't know.
Oh, I see. Wind blew the door of the outhouse unlatched. I'll close it so it doesn't get blown off.
You make it okay, Jim?
Yeah. There we are. Hey, I haven't seen one of those since I was a kid on the farm.
Yeah, we better get upstairs and turn the heat on and get the post operating. Coming, Jim?
Right behind you, Joe. Right behind you.
Instead of the wind letting up as the darkness fell and the first hour dragged by, the wind increased its fury, rattled the windows in the tower room. Occasionally, a timber below would creak.
Joe? I'm going outside in the catwalk.
Hey, you might get blown off. The wind's worse.
Well, we came up here tonight to listen for airplanes, didn't we?
Well, sure, but...
Well, we'll have a tough time hearing a plane in here tonight.
Yeah, I guess you're right. I'm beginning to think we'd be safer down on the ground.
Hey, feel that. You can really feel this tower sway now. What was that?
Hey, something's giving way. Come on, Jim, let's get out of here. Snap the outside light on so we can see.
Hey, the whole tower's going again.
Yeah, quick, down the steps.
Keep going, John,
I'm
hurry.
As fast as I can. Come on, hurry up. The tower's going. The whole tower's going.
Let her go. We're down safe, at least.
Hey, wait a minute.
Huh? Oh, yeah. It isn't the tower that's going.
Oh, now I see. Look at it roll down that hill, Jim.
Gosh, our new outhouse. Pulled up by the roots.
Yeah, gone with the wind.
The tower stood strong and solidly. It was the outbuilding that was carried away to be crashed to splinters at the bottom of the hill. Next day, a small and somewhat sheepish committee returned to call upon Mr. Paul Fagan.
Well, boys, what can I do for you?
We gave you back a little too much money, Mr. Fagan.
What's that?
Well, something happened we hadn't counted on.
The elements tossed us a curve.
We have a few new construction costs to face.
What's happened? How much do you need?
Well, $40 will cover lumber and labor.
All right. But for what?
Last night, Mr. Fagan... In a high wind, our observation post's restroom was carried away.
It was. Well, here, I'll give you back $40. But when you fellas build the next one, anchor it down to a good, solid cement foundation or something. After all, we can't just be tossing money to the wind these days.
Mm-hmm. And such were the trials and tribulations that fraught the early history of the Hillsborough, California Observation Post. Today, over 200 observers report regularly, carrying on their watches with precision and high efficiency. We salute all who have made Fagan Tower an outstanding unit of the Aircraft Warning Service.
Since Eyes Aloft took the air, countless postcards, letters, and telegrams have come in to say that you like the program. Well, it's indeed gratifying to hear from you. Observers and filter center workers will be interested to know that through this program, others are already offering their services as volunteer civilian members of the 4th Fighter Command of the Army Air Forces. Those who wish to share the gigantic task of guarding their homeland from possible attack by enemy plane should contact their local, county, or city defense council.
The McKinley Diary. McKinley, Oregon is located in the geographical center of the Pacific Coast area. We think you'll agree that the people who operate McKinley Post typify the true spirit of the Ground Observer Corps. Green forests of fir, pine, and spruce drop down from rolling mountains to the valley floor, where nestles the little community of McKinley. Even now, shrub maple bushes are turning yellow, orange, and red with an early suggestion of autumn. In pastures, clumps of wild berry vines hang heavy with ripened fruit. The valley air is a symphony of midsummer perfumes. Where the valley bends, so does the gravel road. And at this bend is the farm on which the McKinley Post is located. The unpainted little frame shack stands sentinel beneath a great oak cherry tree. Inside, laying open on the card table, is a notebook, a diary of the watchers. Each week, we read one or two brief entries made by a McKinley Post observer. Here, now, let's turn to a page at random. May 14th, 9:30 a.m. to 3 p.m.
Here I is again, all alone with my little self. I is so bored with myself. I think I will report 100 Jap planes are over my little head. But if I do, I get a whipping. Alice Sprague.
And one more entry. Monday, May 25th.
1 o'clock in the morning. All is quiet now. Mr. Abernathy and I arrived at 7 in a hard rain. I slept most of the time until 11:45. I wonder if I snored as loudly as Mr. Abernathy is snoring at present. I've just eaten part of my lunch. Milk, sandwich, raisins, and cake. I left home this evening after helping to cut my birthday cake. Little Maple blew out the lone candle that lighted the 49 that my wife, Mildred, had formed on the white frosting with wild strawberries that the boys, Forest and Canyon, had searched through the wet grass to find. The children were still eating cake when I left. The rain on my birthday reminded me of another rainy birthday. I was in France. The lovely horse chestnut trees drip water from their sturdy blossoms. I was walking along a road bordering the Loire River. The rain stopped, and the sun came out and shone warmly as I entered Amboise. A woman and two children were standing near the rock wall that rose directly from the water's edge. As I approached, I was startled to hear the woman call out in English, "You are an American." I was proud of my uniform that day. Always in France, I was treated with great respect by the men and women I met there. It is those men and women whom I think of when I think of the France of today. France, crushed and helpless, led alike by brutal enemy and heartless traitor. A mere memory of its former greatness because its people could not believe that such a blow could ever fall on them. Let us hope that enough Americans remain always awake so that our country can never be crushed like France. There is little enough that most of us can do to protect our country. I, for one, can listen for hostile airplanes while my family sleeps in peace. Signed, T.S. Easton.
Mm-hmm. here is Ken Carpenter to chat for a few minutes with a man whom I'm sure you will all find extremely interesting. The last man to fly out of Bataan, Major Henry Thorne.
Well, Major Thorne, I understand you had a pretty tight scrape getting out of Bataan with your life.
Yes, I was lucky. I happened to get my plane off just as the Japs came running onto the Bataan flying field.
You mean they were close enough to fire on you?
I should say they were. Their rifle bullets were flying all about our heads.
Our heads? You had somebody in the plane with you?
Two pilots were jammed into the cramped baggage compartment space in the back of my plane.
And you were still able to get up in the air all right?
Yes, and just in time. With the extra load, the ship was heavy, and we were just about ready to run out of runway when I finally felt the OP-35 start climbing.
Just when was that, Major?
I'll never forget that date, nor the hour. It was 8:30 p.m., April the 8th.
Where'd you fly to?
Cebu. A few days later, we hopped off for Mindanao, the southernmost large island of that archipelago. We were ferried back to Australia by General Royce's bombardment flight. He came up to the Philippines on a bombing mission about that time.
Major Thorne, have you any idea how many of our men were captured at Bataan, or can you answer that question?
I don't know. But I should presume about 9,000 or 10,000 American troops were taken and are still held prisoner there.
How long were you on Bataan?
5 days short of a year and 11 months in the Philippines, on Bataan proper about 4 months.
Oh, and you really know the whole story there. Did you have any sort of an established ground aircraft warning service there?
Not much, but a good ground observer corps would have been of inestimable value.
To warn you flyers of the approach of Jap air squadrons, huh?
Yes, we tried to establish a ground observer system, but the lack of telephone lines made it almost impossible.
Oh, then you people did try to build a system.
Yes. There were a few miles of telephone lines up to San Fernando Valley on the island of Luzon. We tried to pick our observers carefully, but the Japs had a well-organized fifth column working for them.
Fifth column? What happened?
Well, they'd cut in on our lines and give us erroneous reports. Well,
such as what, Major Thorne?
They'd call in and say, "Flash, flash, many bombers high."
There was no way you could trace those misleading reports?
No way. And when a report would come, we couldn't take a chance of not getting our planes up in the air. You see, a plane in the air is a deadly weapon of war. On the ground, an airplane is most vulnerable, especially where we were. We had little chance to hide them.
Well, then you really think that if there'd been an adequate ground observer corps on the island, the story might have been a bit different?
Certainly. We'd have had a chance to protect ourselves. We would have been warned of Jap approaches.
Well, then, Major Thorne, you're saying to the people here at home that the Volunteer Civilian Aircraft Warning Service has a real value.
I cannot possibly overemphasize how truly valuable an efficient, well-manned ground observer corps can be in protecting this Pacific coast from an invasion of the enemy by air.
Well, I'm sure that'll give new courage to the thousands who are carrying on this work.
That work must be carried on. And the Volunteer Civilian Army of men and women are the ones who must do it. I salute every person who is sharing this vital task. They mustn't forget the boys who are still at Bataan.
Well, thank you, Major Thorne, and the best of luck always.
Our last true life story today concerns a filter center. A2, Army Intelligence, will allow us to tell you only that a filter center is a nerve center in this vast aircraft warning service. Into dozens or more filter centers on the Pacific coast flow the thousands of hourly reports of the ground observers. This is the story of the organization of the Eugene, Oregon Filter Center. Last fall, a personable young lieutenant of the 4th Fighter Command had a big job dumped into his lap by his superior officer.
Well, Lieutenant, here's the building.
Uh-huh. That's all I have to work with, Major?
I'll give you half a dozen soldiers.
What else, Major?
My best wishes.
When do I start?
Today.
Well, could I have a day to go back to Portland to close my apartment, bring my wife down?
Well, Lieutenant, I don't want to seem unreasonable, but every minute counts in getting this thing organized. I'm afraid your wife will have to close the apartment and arrange to get down here by herself. You've got to start work at once, Ray.
I see, sir. I'll start today, Major. Right now, in fact.
The young lieutenant was Ray Siegenthaler. He had been handed a big job. At the unknown address in Eugene, the telephone company engineers had completed their installation of equipment. Other than that, Lieutenant Siegenthaler had little to work with than a half a dozen bare rooms. Unexpectedly, on December 7th, the Eugene Filter Center was suddenly activated, as was the rest of the aircraft warning service. Lieutenant Siegenthaler really went to work then. His office that morning.
Sergeant Perkins.
Yes, sir.
Here's another list of names. Start telephoning these, will you? Tell the women to get here at once.
Yes, sir.
Lieutenant.
Yes, Mrs. Lucky.
Until we get shifts organized, some of the women will have to work right on into the night.
I realize that. What about it?
Well, we'll have to arrange to feed them something. They'll get hungry, they'll be on nerves, and they should at least have coffee.
Well, we have no facilities here for preparing food.
Lieutenant Sigenthaler.
Yes, O'Brien?
Some of the ladies I've called want to come, but they don't have transportation on such short notice. What do we do?
Take a couple of carry-all trucks and go after them.
Yes, sir. But are civilians supposed to be transported by Army equipment, sir?
No, O'Brien, they aren't. But this is an emergency. We've got to get this station in operation. I'll take the cars and go after the people this time, and I'll take full responsibility. But do it.
Yes, sir, at once, sir.
Now, Mrs. Lucky, I just got an idea, I think, that'll fix that food problem.
Oh.
Call the Delray Cafe for me, will you?
Yes, sir.
I want to speak to Mrs. Benke. Get her right away.
Yes, sir.
Sergeant Perkins, good luck with your list.
I've called three already. They're on the way.
Good.
Lieutenant Sigenthaler.
Yes, Rush?
I'm reporting from the filter board room. Mrs. Moorhead says the observers are starting to call in reports already.
Well, go back and tell the girls on duty to do the best they can. Tell them that more help is on the way right now.
Yes, sir. I'll tell
them. Oh, here's Mrs. Benke on the phone, Lieutenant.
Thanks. Hello? Hello, Nita? Lieutenant Sigenthaler, over at the filter center. Yeah. Say, I'm going to have a bunch of hungry gals here along about 6 o'clock, and I won't be able to let them off duty. Now, you run a restaurant. How can we work it out? Oh, no, I wasn't asking for that, Nita. Now, wait a minute. Well, sure, but we'll take up a collection. I know, but you can't feed this mob. Hello? Hello? She hung up on me.
Well, what did she say, Lieutenant?
Nita Benke insists on having it her way. She's sending over sandwiches, coffee and stuff, and the waitresses from her cafe.
Oh, that Nita Benke's a human dynamo. I don't suppose I should say this to an officer.
What's that?
Well, I think you're an A1 chiseler. And don't think the folks here at the Filter Center won't admire you for it, because they will.
Come on here, everybody. Let's get to work. Time's a-wasting.
As an example of Eugene community spirit and cooperation, Mrs. Onita Benke, proprietress of the Delray Cafe, started on December 7th to take charge of feeding the Filter Center workers. And she's been at it ever since. That wasn't all Mrs. Benke did. She called on merchants in Eugene, presented them with a proposition.
Now, Mr. Huntington, I've opened up accounts at the First National Bank and the Eugene branch of the U.S. National.
Now, where'd you get all the money, Nita?
Well, now, look, it's going to take quite a few donations to keep those accounts in operation.
Here I go, Nita, digging into my pocket. What's it for?
To maintain the filter center. To buy things to make the place comfortable.
How much do you want?
Well, I don't want to handle any money. That's why I opened the bank accounts. They're in the name of the filter center. People can just go to the banks and deposit whatever they can afford.
Say now, Nita, that's a terrific idea. I take off my hat to a brand new way of financing a worthwhile venture.
Others in the community felt the keen desire to help. Lieutenant Sigenthaler went to talk to Godlove, the plumber.
Well, you better watch out for me, Mr. Godlove. I've come here to your place to ask for something.
You're getting a reputation being quite a chiseler, Lieutenant. Now, what we need over there is a... Oh, excuse me, before I forget about it, Lieutenant. You see that batch of pipe and fittings there on the floor?
Yeah.
And that sink?
Yeah.
I did a little chiseling myself. I went over to Tillman's Hardware Company and talked Mr. Tillman into donating that sink. I'm giving the pipe and the labor myself. I'll install it.
Install it?
Sure, at the filter center. We need a sink over there and the place we made into the kitchen. Some place to wash dishes and the like.
Well, gosh, Mr. Godlove, that's what I came over to ask you for.
Really?
Hey, you beat me to the punch this time.
And so the Eugene Filter Center gradually took shape. A first aid station was built at one of the rooms. A comfortable woman's rest lounge was converted of donated properties. Mrs. Hallie Huntington took the responsibility of getting the recreation room together. The Garrett Appliance Company donated a large Frigidaire for the kitchen. An electric coffee urn came from the Delray Cafe. In other words, out of nothing, inspired by the young commanding officer, Lieutenant Sigenthaler, the citizens of Eugene, Oregon have built and maintained one of the most comfortable, efficient, successful filter center organizations in the system.
Oh, again, may I interrupt one moment?
Why, certainly, Ken.
We'd like to beat Walter Winchell with this report.
What's that?
Well, just this. Ladies and gentlemen, before too long a time, Lieutenant and Mrs. Ray Sigenthaler of Eugene, Oregon, will have a new little commander in their home barracks. Congratulations.
Hey, that is news. And will that Eugene Filter Center be buzzing with gossip in the morning?
Each week, we present the National Broadcasting Company's Eyes Aloft Gold Trophy Award to some outstanding observation post or filter center.
Here now is Captain Russell Z. Smith, Ground Observation Officer of the Southern California region, to announce this week's winner and make the award. Captain Smith.
This week, the Eyes Aloft Gold Trophy Award is presented to the Eugene, Oregon Fielder Center for splendid morale, for community cooperation, and for outstanding service to the 4th Fighter Command. We salute the Eugene Fielder Center.
Immediately at the conclusion of this program, the gold trophy will be flown to Eugene. Tomorrow morning, Lieutenant Siegenthaler will formally present the handsome trophy to his workers at the Fielder Center. This is Gayne Whitman bidding goodnight to the 150,000 aircraft warning service workers who keep 24-hour-a-day vigil on our home front. Good night.
Tune in again next week and hear another thrilling human interest broadcast of Eyes Aloft. This series is written and produced by Robert L. Redd. Music is composed and conducted by Gordon Jenkins. This is Ken Carpenter charging you to always remember Eyes Aloft.
Eyes aloft, watching the sky, watching for planes, flying the lanes up above.
Eyes Aloft has come to you from Hollywood. This is the National Broadcasting Company.
Eyes Aloft on Tuned to Yesterday from August 31st, 1942 on NBC. Gayne Whitman, the host of the show, often heard on radio and in uncredited appearances in film, though his last gig was for a radio show-turned-TV series, Sergeant Preston of the Yukon, where he played the narrator. And so closes this hour of True History on Tuned to Yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great shows from radio's past. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark Levanier. Thanks for tuning in.